Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, Luke O'Neill. Good morning.
Good morning, Pat. How's it going?
It's going very well. Now, so many things to talk about. The first thing, I suppose, is with all the talk of vaccines, when they will...
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Mater Private. Trust Ireland's leading private hospitals with locations nationwide, including Dublin, Cork and Limerick.
This is News Talk.
Will arrive? Will they be safe and all the rest of it? Moderna boss saying there wouldn't be one until at least the end of the year. That's if everything goes well. We are involved in an alliance.
Here we are. It's a good one, this, but there's a thing called COVAX. So 156 countries have united together under the umbrella of the WHO. Of course, they're the organiser of this. And then two organisations, Gavi and CEPI, they're well known in the vaccine business. They're trying to get vaccines to the developing world, is their mission. So they've all come together and said, look, we've got to make sure there's equitable access to vaccines. And Ireland's part of it. Some EU countries are in there. Of course, Russia, America and China are not taking part, disappointingly. They tried to get them involved, but they said no. But the bottom line is that they're buying 2 billion doses of vaccines. Isn't that amazing? And getting ready now to vaccinate the world. Because what's happening really is there are 10 vaccines now in phase 3. It's gone to 10, which is fantastic news, of course, because so many shots on goal there. And optimism is growing. And when the vaccine arrives, get it out quick is the idea. So this COVAX organisation is now, you know, on top of that, basically trying to make sure that the vaccine goes to where it's most needed. Mm.
Where are they getting the money? What's the budget?
Yeah, they need $2 billion for this, and they've raised $1.4 billion already. And governments are coughing up at the European Union is contributing to this, and the companies that make the vaccines are also contributing. And then philanthropy, it's a combination of several sources. They're trying to raise another $600 million. The two companies that have signed up are AstraZeneca, which, as we know, that's the Oxford vaccine, and Sanofi, they've got a vaccine as well. So those two have already stepped up. They're pressing Moderna now, you see, and Pfizer, and the other one saying, we need money off you guys as well. And it's a funny one, isn't it? Because obviously the drug companies would give them money and they'll buy the vaccine back off them. But remember, mm-hmm. the federal US government are funding these companies as well, and so is the EU. So the finances of this are quite complicated. What it means, Pat, is free vaccines, remember, because these 2 billion doses will now be made available. And they've also done a calculation, Pat, which is a really important one. They need to vaccinate 20% of people in each country initially. Now, those 20% are the healthcare workers, first and foremost, and then the vulnerable, you know. And that's the kind of number of people, 20% roughly, that are in this vulnerable group. And that's the first set of people that the vaccine's given to.
Okay. And do they have a target as to when that might take place? Now, this is presuming we have successful phase 3 trials and maybe the launch of a vaccine to the first cohort early in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, the truth of it is, Pat, we still don't know if the vaccines are going to work, even though all this activity sounds promising, and of course it is. There's no proven vaccine yet. The safety profile, first and foremost, safety. And as we discussed last week, the 60,000 patient trial with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So you've never seen the like of it. I'm not exaggerating, every hour I get a little message about the vaccine business because it's so huge. Hugely active at the moment for obvious reasons, and we just got to keep our fingers crossed. But they must, I mean, I wonder, Pat, that they know something we don't know, and they're a bit more optimistic than we are, because they really are going for this hell for leather for obvious reasons. And that's right. I mean, then they'll roll out. I mean, if we keep our fingers firmly crossed, it's November, December, January, we'll be getting results from the trials with the safety signal saying it's safe and efficacy, and then you begin to roll this out amazingly, sort of January, February, March, April next year. That's if everything goes 100%, of course.
Now, you can understand why they're doing this, because I was just thinking, I'm very interested in battery technology for electric cars and so on. And there are all sorts of things that work on the bench, but they won't put them out there until they've tested them, until they've scaled them up and tested them, so that in the real world, when you're trying to charge a car battery quickly, this is like a large battery yep. for an electric car, it might go on fire. Or if there's a crash, the automobile crashes, what happens to the battery then? Is it going to go on fire? Is it going to... So they have this technology, but they won't roll it out until it's absolutely safe. And yet there are people, you know who would push out vaccine technology without those kind of safeguards.
Yeah, yeah, that's the fear. And this morning, Pat, have you seen a survey in Ireland that 1 in 3 won't take a vaccine, they're saying now? And so that feeds that fear, doesn't it, in a way? And when we see the likes of Donald Trump trying to rush things, that's a big mistake. We've got to be really careful. This has to be the most safest product ever, almost, is the way to think of it, for all kinds of reasons. So you're right. That's why these companies are so cautious, because the fear of it having a side effect is huge, isn't it? So that's why they're being extremely careful.
I mean, think of thalidomide way back, which was a morning sickness pill, which had devastating effects on those who came to term their mothers having taken that that drug. It's useful for other things to this day, isn't that so?
But not cancer.
Yeah. So there you are. Now, the other thing about those stats, $2 billion for 2 billion doses, that's a buck a dose. Is that realistic?
They think so, yeah. I mean, the pricing is a funny one. How do you price something like this, Pat, in a sense? Because they can make billions of doses and then the drug company will try to figure out what to charge people. You see, with normal vaccines anyway, there's a price associated with them. And it's obviously, it's not just the price of making it. They want to make a profit. I mean, it is a business, remember. But in this phase of this crisis, profit is very much down on their priority list. Let's put it that way. So they're optimistic that $2 billion investment will vaccinate 20% of these countries that need the vaccine, you know, so they've done the calculations there already.
Now, the second topic we want to talk about is shielding, and we've heard probably some relatively heartless individuals saying all those people who are vulnerable, who've got underlying conditions, and all those people who are L1s and alphas, let them stay at home, let them be shielded from exposure to the greater world, and the rest of us will just get on with it. Does shielding work?
Well, this is what's worrying, but there's a study saying it doesn't. Now, again, it's such an important question for us, isn't it? Now, if we look at the more negative scenario, if we fast forward 6 to 9 months and there isn't a vaccine, what the hell are we going to do then? You know, we have to think about shielding again, I guess. So it's a very important topic. At the moment, of course, nobody should be proposing shielding because it's extremely difficult to achieve. And there's a study showing that they looked at 1.3 million people in a population. 32,000 were shielded, which meant they were mainly in nursing homes and looked after. They did their best not to, you know, to protect them. And guess what? There was still a level of infection in that group. In spite of their best efforts, they couldn't keep the virus out of these vulnerable people. Now, the reason is that it's so contagious, and that's what that tells us. With the best one in the world, it's very hard to shield. And by the way, Pat, we use the word shielding, another phrase. I mean, these words were kicking around for decades, remember, in other infections. It's called extended isolation. Let's call it that instead. Do you want to put all the older people in this country into extended isolation? I mean, it's like going to jail, isn't it? So it's a really important thing to consider. And this study has shown it didn't really work. And it was a really, you know, precise analysis. They follow these people in nursing homes and other places where they were trying to shield them. And if anything, they had a slightly higher rate of infection, which was also disturbing. Now, that was partly because they were a vulnerable group and they were more likely to get infected anyway. And one reason, Pat, is if you want to shield, all the people working in those places have to be isolated as well. They can't go outside. And their families have to go in with them into these shielded facilities. So it's really an unfeasible thing to propose, is the conclusion from this piece anyway.
So if, for example, you have a nursing home population, all of those who work in the nursing home, from the cooks in the kitchen to the person at reception to the therapeutic staff and so on, They couldn't go home either.
Yeah, they've done a calculation about 25% of the population of a country would have to shield, right? Because that would include the vulnerable and the people looking after them. You know, so 1 in 4 people then have to go into extended isolation. The other big question is, how long for? Is it 3 months? Is it 6 months? Is it a year? We just don't know. I mean, it's just that's what makes it unfeasible as well.
So I'm just thinking of a place where people might be living a shielded life, in a nursing home, for example. It'd be like an inverted leper colony, where you have the healthy people inside and the lepers are passing the food through the cracks in the gate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a strange analogy, but you're right. Yeah. Again, obviously they're looking at this because they are preparing. We may have to do this if this continues. We've got to get something going. You know, now it's, you know, it's the terrible vista, isn't it? So there will be people trying to plan for this, saying if it has to happen in a year's time. But right now, we don't need to be doing this, and it's very unfeasible, is the view.
Now, have you a cold? Or maybe that's the flu. Oh, for heaven's sake, it's COVID-19. How do we know?
Yeah, this is a great one. The NHS in the UK, Pat, has got a really good poster. I'd recommend everybody prints it off and puts it on their fridge. I've tweeted about it, actually. This is a great poster. The NHS produced it. It's a very nice table comparing cold to flu to COVID-19. And can you tell from the symptoms what you might have and what you might not have? Now, of course, some people have a mixture of symptoms anyway, so it's not definitive. But certainly there are ways to say, oh, have I got COVID? Have I not? What are the chances that I have it? And of course, the key thing for COVID is a fever. That's the first one. A persistent dry cough, and you lose your sense of taste and smell. Those those three are three of the key symptoms you see. Whereas for a cold, a runny nose is the key feature, and sneezing, that's much less common in COVID. So there immediately we see a difference, you know. And as you remember, I think it was said when the schools reopened, if your kid has a runny nose, it's okay. It's probably a cold, and that's true, you see. And then the flu is the tricky one, Pat, because that does have fever. It does have a dry cough. Sometimes you've got a runny nose with the flu. So that's kind of a distinguishing feature.
But anyway, you shouldn't be spreading the flu around either.
Exactly.
Stay at home if you've got the flu.
Yeah, precisely. So it's quite a useful thing, I think. Now the bottom of the poster says, if in doubt, ask your GP. Remember, that's always the guideline, you see. So that's important. But still, it's a nice poster, because in red on the poster are the distinguishing features of each colds versus flus versus COVID-19. So it's a good first go at trying to see if your symptoms are consistent with COVID-19.
Yeah, interestingly, in Britain, I mean, they have made a terrible mess of things over there. Their app is far too complicated for a lot of people to use. You had Boris Johnson not knowing his own rules that he was laying down. And then you have the health secretary admitting that he was wrong about vitamin D. They said that the government had conducted tests on vitamin D and it was useless, and now they've had to do a U-turn on that.
It's terrifying. It's a terrifying business. And the NHS is very good, though, remember. They're doing their best to counter that kind of thing, you know, and get the messaging much more clearly. I quite like sneezing, Pat. If you're sneezing, it's unlikely to be COVID-19. There's one that distinguishes it as well, whereas sneezing is more the common cold.
Now, let's talk about what Regeneron are up to. I saw a piece about hamster ovaries, and you were going to talk about Regeneron anyway, because one of the reports I read said that they reached a point and everyone was wearing a mask, but they knew behind the masks that everybody was beaming.
Yeah, well, this is a great story, Pat, to be honest. And I became aware of this myself about 2 days ago. So Regeneron are a big drug company. They've got very interesting products for all kinds of diseases. They've got a huge factory in Limerick. Let's give Limerick a shout out. And the IDA got them into Ireland. They employ loads of people in Limerick. They took over the Dell factory, actually, in Limerick, which had been vacant. And they've just announced they've got a really good, what's called a cocktail of antibodies. And the first trial has come out, and it protects against COVID-19. Now, again, it's more evidence, Pat, that this antibody based therapy approach will show promise. And many of us have said this is the first big hope, by the way, that we'll get there with something that'll be very, very useful. And lo and behold, Regeneron, lot of effort. And the hamster ovary thing is that's a standard way to make antibodies, strangely. You can culture cells in a lab from hamster's ovaries, strange as it may seem. You can insert the gene for the antibodies into that cell line, and they pump out antibodies to beat the band. So that's a production mechanism to make lots of antibodies. And Regeneron, like many companies, have that technology. But the trial was striking, Pat, because, and it's scientifically very sound, because what they showed was people who've got severe disease are inclined to have less antibodies themselves. So their immune system isn't working properly for whatever reason. They can't make antibodies. Give those people antibodies. And lo and behold, that worked. They were especially protected. And what happened was a lot less time in hospital, symptoms less severe if you give the antibodies to these people. They didn't look at mortality yet. It's just sort of the first trial, I guess. But that was good scientific evidence. Those with plenty of antibodies still had some symptoms, and they didn't really respond because their antibodies were already topped up naturally, if you know what I mean. So it's a replacement thing, in a way, that the people with less antibodies give them the antibody. And the antibody, Pat, is to the spike. Of course, remember the famous spike protein that the virus used to stick into your lungs. And remember the analogy, like blue tack masks, that spike, that's what those antibodies do. So again, we see this as a really important study, and it looks extremely promising, I have to say.
Yeah, I was reading about that spike, another paper that I came across. Like, I read in the popular press, whereas you're reading the basic science and checking up on the credentials and the provenance of all these things, about the spike changing shape 12 times or something in trying to lock into your cells.
Yeah, it's intensely complicated. But if you're a biochemist like me, it's a fascination to see this in action. I mean, they've got the structure of the spike. They can see it. Remember last week we spoke about this little fatty acid sticking into it. So the amount of information on this single protein now is vast, and again the antibodies then will stop the thing changing shape, you see, and then it can't get, the key can't go in the lock then, you see. So the science behind this is extremely robust. The second thing that's really interesting, Pat, is they're getting ready to make lots of this. Now these antibody therapies are more expensive than a vaccine. They have to be given every 2 or 3 weeks, because it's like giving someone a medicine, I suppose, and so that creates, I suppose, issues. But they've decided, Pat, to the factory in Limerick, all the things they make around the world are going to get made in Limerick to free up those factories elsewhere to make these antibodies. Isn't that amazing? So they're getting ready now to produce millions and millions of doses of this. And Ireland will play its part here because, you know, in other words, the Regeneron plant in Limerick will take over production of everything. The other places are free now to make lots of antibodies. So they're getting ready now to roll it out. Remember, they're still doing trials, though. Let's not jump the gun just yet. This is the first step in the process to say this might work.
Still, it's an ill wind, as the saying goes. Now, the other paper I saw, common antioxidant enzyme may provide potential treatment for COVID-19. What is this catalase thing?
Yeah, exactly. I think I've discussed before, when you have a massive inflammatory reaction, and COVID-19 is an inflammatory disease in your lungs, you get lots of reactive oxygen. Now, these are like bleach, effectively, is made in your lungs. Remember, that's trying to fight the infection naturally, you know. But the trouble is, you get too much of this stuff, and now it starts to damage your tissues. And someone said, let's try these antioxidants. And I think we'd mentioned a couple of these before. Mm-hmm. But now there's another one. It's called catalase. It's a well-known enzyme that can mop up these what are called free radicals. They can mop up all the nasty oxygen oxidizing material. And again, there's evidence now from animals initially in humans that this might benefit as well, because you can imagine there if this bleach in your body is doing all the harm, or part of the harm anyway, if you can mop it up, you're going to limit the damage and limit the inflammation, and that'll be very useful. And then the second thing they talk about, but you wouldn't have read the scientific paper, but this could prevent long COVID, remember, because if we can stop the damage happening when you're infected, the chance of it turning into a lingering disease is a lot less, because there's less scarring, less injury overall. So we see these approaches not just in terms of saving people's lives, which is of course the first goal. Secondly, it's to stop symptoms persisting forever, and that catalase approach they're suggesting could be very useful for that. So that's another good example of something that's beginning to show a bit of promise.
Now, the News Talk listeners are absolutely on the button about their questions. Given that a Hong Kong resident got reinfected with a different strain of COVID-19, does it mean that any vaccine we develop will be of limited use?
That's the superb. There's two big questions here, but anyway, even the notion of shielding, remember, that strategy is about hoping immunity builds up in the population. In other words, you shield the vulnerable and everybody else, you know, gets over it and then is protected. And again, the evidence at the moment is as follows, and it's getting clearer by the day. There'll be a range of responses. Some will be protected from reinfection completely. Some won't. Most will be in the middle. They will get reinfected but get less severe disease. So that's most infectious diseases have this. It's called a normal distribution. Now, a vaccine is very different from the actual live virus, because the live virus can shut off your immune system. It can manipulate it in various ways. You know, it's very cunning. You know, a vaccine is dead virus or a piece of the virus, like the spike protein, with an immune stimulant called an adjuvant that can cause a huge response, you see, in your body. You make loads of antibodies, loads of T cells. They become memory cells and they should protect you. So in other words, even though the natural infection mightn't be as great at causing population-wide protection, vaccines are. And that's the history of vaccines, by the way. They were designed to do just that. So it's very different from the natural infection.
How important is America to the vaccine effort? If Joe Biden becomes president, will it be of benefit to the entire world, because he might get Americans more behind it?
Yeah, well, first of all, they'll rejoin the WHO, but let's start with that, which is extremely important. I mean, the fact that they left the WHO is a scandal of the highest order. And the fact that Biden is on record, I think he is anyway, isn't he? You probably know them more than me, but certainly the Democrats would say, we will rejoin the WHO. So that's the first thing. That means they buy into this. This COVAX initiative is led by the WHO, you see. So if you're a member, you're kind of obliged to pay your dues, I suppose. So I suspect what will happen there is they will rejoin and then they will participate in COVAX. And remember, most Americans want to help the world. Let's not make any bones about it. And several of the vaccines are American companies. Of course, they want to roll it. The Americans also know, and the scientists in America are telling the administration, you have to vaccinate the world here because it'll keep coming back. You know, in other words, unless we protect the whole world here, it'll be pointless in the long run.
Yeah. Now, so self-interest demands that you vaccinate the whole world.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and Trump isn't saying that. If you look what they're saying, they're all America first, and they don't say the second sentence is we got to protect the world. And that's ignoring the science. The science tells us the virus will linger in other countries and then will creep back into your country. And it could happen quickly with this virus, but it's so contagious. Remember, it went from a single person infected. Look at the numbers, you know, in a few months. So they've got to, the bottom line is you've got to help the whole world here if you have a vaccine.
Can you ask Luke what he thinks about plans to introduce rapid testing at airports? Will this be better than quarantines? And that other question about the WHO, of course, they're talking about introducing into the developing world 15, 20-minute testing. Why can't we have it too?
That's the plan, I believe. I'd love to get more on that myself. I mean, everybody's saying this in the stuff I'm reading, that testing is the way out. Rapid, as we said the other week, rapid testing everywhere is the answer. Some of the key weapons to use. So I'm longing for that day, Pat. Let's say we fast forward. If we're optimistic, let's say it's 3 months from now, we'll all have loads of tests in our houses and in airports and in schools. It'll be an easy 15-minute test. And there's a massive effort to try and achieve that, remember. And as the weeks go by, we're seeing more evidence that there are these tests becoming more and more available. So let's make sure we're part of that.
Can you ask Luke whether someone with juvenile arthritis is at high risk, as I'm on immunosuppressants?
Yes, anybody on immunosuppressants, you see, and that can be any autoimmune disease. And juvenile arthritis is another autoimmune disease. And if you're on immunosuppressants, you've just got to be careful. Now, this doesn't mean locking yourself up or avoiding things. Just be wary of all the usual things. Wear the mask, wash your hands, stay away from people, sadly, for this period. And then you should be fine, you know, but it's something to be aware of course.
If just one company is successful in making the vaccine, would they share that information with other manufacturers so that vaccines can be made on a much larger scale, or will they just trademark it and keep all the profits?
But again, the spotlight on this is so harsh, Pat. If a single drug company gets a vaccine and they say it's just for us and nobody else, that's not going to look good. Let's put it that way. And of course, companies are very aware of their image, aren't they? You know, So the prediction is whoever gets there first will share. And they're sharing already. I mean, that Regeneron example I gave, Pat, they're in collaboration with Roche, a company very important to me, by the way. So they're working together. GSK are working with several companies, you know, and it's unprecedented cross-company collaboration here at the moment. It's happening on unprecedented in the history of pharmaceuticals, really, because again, the mission is to get a solution to this, you see, for all kinds of other reasons to do with economic worries and so on. So I would be optimistic if one company gets there first. You could well see three or four companies making that vaccine in combination, you know, together to get the supplies up.
Brian and Dublin giving out, rather than insanely talking about these fears, how about talking to the EU regulators who have oversight, because thalidomide was 70 years ago. But I just gave that as an example how important testing, phase three testing would be.
Right. Thalidomide changed the industry. That tragedy, they absolutely realised we can't have this ever happen again, you know. And all the safety measures in drug trials kind of came in after thalidomide, you know. So that was a wake-up call, basically, you know. So that was a good example of the industry responding to something that was very negative.
Now, this one here. I won't take a vaccine if it's manufactured by a US or a Russian lab. So says Shane and Talla. What would you say to Shane?
You can see why he's saying that. This is what worries me is I'm not surprised that Shane would say that, because look what's happening in the media about these vaccines. You would be concerned, you know? And that's why it's our job to try to reassure and say, well, hang on a minute, you know, let's hope that whichever company gets there first has done everything properly, you know? And again, it's going to be an uphill battle, Pat, to convince people to use vaccines. And it's understandable why people are reluctant, given the way they're being pitched at the moment, you see. And I understand that fear.
Could you ask Luke, how is the common cold passed around? I'm just coming out of a cold, but I'm washing my hands, I'm wearing a face mask. If I could catch a cold, surely I could catch COVID.
Sadly, it's dumb luck in a way. And this is absolutely right. So it's very variable, remember. I mean, if you're unlucky to be sitting beside one with a massive cold and they're exuding gallons of viruses at you, you know, even if you're doing everything, a bit of virus might penetrate your barriers and get into your body and infect you. You know, so that's why people pick up colds. It's not a binary thing in a way. You know, it's kind of just the dose you're getting off someone if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time on a dart or something. Now, of course, the hope is, as we've seen this in Australia, the flu level went down hugely because of all these measures. And that was evidence in a way that the measures are working, if you like. You see, same with colds. We would predict there should be less colds and flus this winter if we're all observing the guidelines. Of course, there should.
Okay, let's see this one. Oh, it's about your book, your new book. It's coming out on the 2nd of October. Can it be got in shops like Easton's? Is it only available online? If so, what's the link? I suppose there's no chance that Luke would sign a copy.
Isn't it great when your friends plug your book for you? I've told that person to dial in on that one. The book is out on Friday. Tomorrow is the official day, and you can get it now actually online. It's in Dubray on Grafton Street. I was walking past there on the way up. It's in the window. You know, is that great? So there are copies out there already, but the official day is tomorrow.
Yeah, and I suppose we have to bleep the title, do we?
Well, you can say never mind the bullocks. You'll see the way the asterisks are placed. If you choose, you can call it Never Mind the Bullocks, which people might think it's a book about farming, but it's not. It's about science.
It's about science. It's a brilliant book, absolutely. All right, Luke, there we have to draw to a close. We have still more questions coming in, but we resume our conversations on Monday. Luke O'Neill, Professor of Biochemistry at Trinity College in Dublin, thank you very much for joining us.